Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery with KNSJ on the East County Magazine Show. I'm here today with Elizabeth Liu, the founder and CEO of Nile Sisters, an organization helping refugee women and their families here in San Diego. Elizabeth is a winner of the KNSJ People's Microphone Award for her efforts, and she has also received the Eleanor Roosevelt Humanitarian Award from the San Diego chapter of the United Nations. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be here today.
Now, you yourself were a refugee. Elizabeth, you were born in the Sudan, and then when that country became war-torn as a very small child, you and your family moved to Uganda as refugees. What was life like living in a refugee camp?
It is very difficult to be a refugee in the first place. As a refugee in a camp, I experienced a lot of injustice and violence and all that, just like any other refugees who fled here to United States might have experienced in the camps where they came from. My experience as a child in a refugee camp is that one day I was in school.
How old were you?
I think I was 7 or 8.
And what happened?
What happened was that there was a coup. Idi Amin took over from Obote. The soldiers of Idi Amin were collecting soldiers of Obote, and that was very violent.
So you were in the classroom, and one of these soldiers fleeing Idi Amin's army came running in, and what happened?
One of the soldiers ran in our classroom. That was really in the morning after we finished our parade, roll call, and everything. We just entered in our class, and this soldier came and ran in our classroom, and the other soldier of Idi Amin pursued the man, and he was tied down in front of us, the class, and we saw the man was cocking gun, and he pulled out the knife from the gun, the band, and just stabbed this other soldier right there in front of us.
So they bayoneted this man in front of these small children. How horrifying that must have been.
Yes, blood was everywhere, all over. And us, the small children, who were screaming and running to the door to escape for our lives, you can just imagine the situation.
And then the school officials told you all to run home.
Yes. When the headmaster of the school saw the violence in the school, he just blew the whistle, brrr, like this, and all the students came out, and he commanded us to leave the school. You know, there was no direction. In this situation, you cannot give direction, and there was no nothing. Call 911, dial this number to call police to bring situation into order.
So what did you do?
Everybody was running. I ran for my life. I ran like 3-4 miles. I ran as if my chest was just bursting, as if I was, you know, losing my breath. But there was nothing I could do other than just keep running.
And what happened when you got home?
When I got home, I found my parents deserted our home. Nobody was at home. And at that point, I just continued running. Take the road that I know. Usually we go that way to stream or to get water. I just ran. And at the end, I found our neighbors in the bush, and they saw me, they welcomed me, they said, shh, don't cry, don't say anything, don't talk. They pulled me, and one of the women put me on her chest. I was just breathing so hard. But they kept me until when situation got a little bit, and then they escaped with me going to look for my parents. And after some distance, then we got my parents, and my dad grabbed me. He put me on his neck. Now that was late evening. We are trying to cross the river, go to the other side where situation is at least better. So the river was flooded. And I could see my dad was really struggling to make sure both of us, he and myself, we are safe. And he was pushing the water from his mouth.
So he had you on his shoulders carrying
yes,
you across?
Yes, he put me on his shoulders and he was walking through the river.
And how deep was the water?
He pushed the water with his right hand. He was holding one of my legs, and I was holding him on his forehead. I was just on his neck, and the situation was so tough. And
so it was up to his chest or his neck?
The water was almost to his chin.
My goodness.
That was how deep he was.
So you finally found a safe haven on the other side for a while, still in Uganda.
Yes.
And then in 1972, a peace accord was signed in the Sudan. And so in 1973, you went back to the homeland that you hadn't seen since you were a very little girl. And I understand you went to school there and got married. Is that correct?
Yes, that's true. After a peace accord, which was called the Addis Ababa Agreement between South and North Sudan, was signed, mm-hmm. my parents came home, and we started life from scratch.
So Elizabeth went to school, she got her degrees, studied family science and public health, and she got married and had five children. But then in 1988, civil war broke out in the Sudan, and once again, she was forced to become a refugee, this time going to Kenya. Elizabeth, tell us what happened next.
Yes, my family and I, we left North Sudan and went to Kenya. That was in 1996. And we were in Kenya for about 3 years. And then we got the resettlement opportunity to come to United States.
How difficult was it making a new home in a new country that was so very different than what you had known?
The systems in each and every country is very difficult. But most importantly, for us refugees who come to United States, we find it very difficult, very, very difficult, because the job search here is different. The culture is different, language is different, healthcare system is different. Everything is just very difficult.
You mentioned even the challenges of navigating the freeways.
Here. Exactly, navigating freeways. We talk about freeways here, but back home in some of the countries I went to and I come from, we don't have freeways. And you are one way here, is there were two ways.
So you decided you wanted to give back, to help other people who'd been through the kinds of things that you've been through, or in some cases, even worse. A lot of people may not realize that San Diego is now the number one refugee resettlement city in America. We take in more refugees each year than even New York City or Los Angeles. So you started the Nile Sisters in 2001. Tell us what your vision was for the organization.
My vision was that I struggled so much to get integrated in the system, and yet I am educated. And I imagine those refugees who are here in the United States and in San Diego, but they had never had opportunity to go to school in their home countries, how hard it is for them to get services, to get integrated. So I started Nile Sisters to help those who are coming to San Diego to get integrated, beginning with the very basic service, learning how to drive and drive on freeway, learning English as a second language so they can be able to communicate with their neighbors, with the people in the community. Even to get a job, they need to be able to communicate with the people.
So you have literacy programs, you have job programs. and you help them get medical care. Now, I understand that some of the women have special needs.
Right. We have prenatal and a child health program. In this program, we work with refugees from accessing health to childbirth, and after birth, how you take care of newborn and how you feed.
And you've told me some of the women were afraid to go to a hospital. They were actually giving birth in their apartments right here in San Diego.
That is so true. In fact, this project is started because through our outreach in the community, we found that some of our refugee women, they give birth in their apartments instead of going to a hospital. And we asked them why this happened. They said, well, one of their neighbors went to hospital to deliver, and she delivered through C-section. And that was so terrifying to them.
They said they were afraid they would be cut open if
exactly,
they went to the hospital.
Exactly. They were afraid that they would be operated, their womb would be opened, and no one wants that.
No.
So
you also provide programs for preschool children, and you help families also, I understand, to help their own children with their homework.
Yes, we have a preschool program for refugee children from age 3 to 5. But when we started this project, we thought we were helping the children, but we found that we are not only helping the children, but we are helping the parents as well. Because most of these parents, they did not have opportunity to go to school. And now teaching their children the ABC, the 1, 2, 3, the colors, the names of fruits and vegetables is like teaching the parents. And so we are educating the whole family in this project.
Now you have people coming from Haiti, Burma, the Middle East, African nations such as the Sudan, Kenya, Somalia.
When Nile Sisters started, initially we started with the African refugees. But as our program grows, we now serve all refugees from Burma, from Middle East, like Afghanistan, Iraqis, Iranians. We also help refugees from Haiti. Everybody in the community, all the refugees in the community who need our service, we just work with them.
So to make it very clear, the people that you serve, for our listeners who may not know the differences, these are not illegal immigrants. These are people who came here with refugee status, which is granted by an international agency, typically the United Nations. Is that how that works?
Correct. All refugees who come from overseas, they have gone through all screens, being health and background check.
So it's and they're persecuted. It's been deemed that it's not safe for them to go back home. They have no other place to go.
Correct. They are refugees and they are not criminals. They have all their criminal background checked, their health issues checked to make sure they are healthy. They are not bringing communicable diseases here in the United States.
Your program is designed not simply as a handout, but more to teach the people how to be self-sufficient and contributing members of society here in the United States.
Correct. As I worked hard to overcome all the barriers and become self-sufficient myself, that is what I teach all refugees who are coming to San Diego. Current programs we have, the driving, the certified nursing assistant, child care, ESL, and job search. These programs are supported and funded by Office of Refugee Resettlement.
And you've had some amazing successes. You serve over 1,000 people a year now on average. And that's not just women and their families, although that was the primary goal when you started, but you've also served men and boys. Can you tell us the story of the lost boys of the Sudan who you helped?
When I said we are working with refugee women and families, we are not serving only women. We are serving men, women, their children, and everybody. Example of the lost boys from Sudan is that when they got here, we worked with them.
These were little boys who were forced to be child soldiers.
Correct. When they left South Sudan, they were less than 10 years old.
My goodness.
They wandered in wilderness. They crossed the desert, came to Kenya, Kakuma refugee camps and Gadahali and all those camps. When they came to United States, to San Diego here, I myself, being a South Sudanese, I know our culture. In our culture, men don't enter kitchen. So these lost boys, they don't have wives. They don't have sisters here. So I took the role of becoming a surrogate mom and educating them on how to do grocery shopping, nutrition, how to prepare food, and how to take care of their apartments and cleaning their appliances and so forth. And also, we trained them to drive and be good drivers.
As they got older, yes.
Yes. And we also did mentoring. We did a lot of connections to them with the host community members, with the churches, with the all, you know, friends that we can get. And now the Lost Boys of Sudan are one of the very successful groups of refugees here in the United States.
How are they doing now today?
They are doing very, very well. I'm so grateful and very honored to be part of their success. These boys went to colleges, prestigious colleges. They went to community colleges as well.
Cuyamaca College right here in East County.
Some of them went to Cuyamaca City College, and they went to Point Loma Nazarene University, to San Diego State, UCSD. And I mean, they all graduated with the very good grades.
Good jobs.
Yes, they get good jobs, and I'm very pleased.
Very good. Well, you are doing amazing work, Elizabeth, and I'm so pleased that you're able to join us today. And congratulations again on being a recipient of the KNSJ People's Microphone Awards. And I'm just delighted that they're able to bestow this honor. You're a very, very deserving person.
Thank you so much. We are only able to provide all these services and keep our door open for refugees through support from community members, from our friends, the board members of Nile Sisters. They love the Nile Sisters. They give us big support. They're always with us, and I'm just honored.
Where are your offices located, Elizabeth?
We are right in the middle of refugees in City Heights. Mm-hmm. We are on University. Our address is 6035 University Avenue, suite number 22, San Diego, California, 92115.
That's just a couple of blocks outside of La Mesa for our East County listeners. Do you need donations, volunteers, supplies? How can people help?
Always, always we are looking for donations, and always we are looking for volunteers. We do tremendous job, but this job, we can only do it when people come and give us support, and we always appreciate donations coming our way.
You can get more information at www.nilesisters.org. Elizabeth, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much. One very quick announcement I would like to make.
Yes.
That Nile Sisters annual banquet is coming up.
When is the annual banquet?
It's going to be in September 21st. Mm-hmm. It's a brunch at 11 a.m. up to 1 p.m. at La Jolla Presbyterian Church.
Very good.
And the information is on our website. People can go to nilesisters.org and click on events, and you will get all the information. We invite everybody to come and support us and also meet the clients we work with, the people we serve. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
You're welcome, Elizabeth. Thank you for joining us today on 89.1 FM Descanso on the East County Magazine Show.
You're listening to East County Magazine, the voice of East County. We reflect your interests, the people's interests, not special interests. As a nonprofit, we rely on community support. You can help us provide community news and reflect a rich diversity of voices by donating or becoming a sustaining member at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
Howdy! East County Magazine and KNSJ invite you to our Barbecue and Wild West Fest on Saturday, August 10th from 4 to 7 p.m. at the historic Descanso Town Hall in Descanso. Round up your friends and family for this fun-filled event. We'll have a Wild West show featuring the Hole in the Wall Gang and the Gaskell Brothers reenacting scenes from our region's colorful Western past.
The Pine Creek Posse Band will provide live music, so grab your partner and bring your dancing shoes, or should we say cowboy boots.
Plus, the Descanso Junction will be cooking up a tri-tip barbecue feast. We'll also have prizes and surprises at our Wild West Fest, which is all a benefit to support our wildfire reporting, alerts, and nonprofit community news. Yee-haw! Reservations are going fast, so save your spot now for our August 10th Wild West Fest. Call 619-698-7617 or email editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Today, you can also find more details at www.eastcountymagazine.org. A state court has sided with a San Diego County ordinance that is bringing a bumper crop of boutique wineries to the backcountry. The California Appellate Court affirmed a lower court ruling, which upheld the legality of the 2010 winery initiative spearheaded by Supervisor Diane Jacob. Barring an appeal to the state Supreme Court, the decision marks the conclusion of a 3-year legal challenge. This is a great victory for vintners, wine lovers, and the region's farm economy, said Jacob, who is vice chairwoman of the Board of Supervisors. By reducing costly and burdensome regulations, she said, the ordinance has uncorked a new collection of boutique businesses. In Ramona, a federally designated viticulture area, there are now 20 tasting rooms today, compared to just one when the ordinance was approved. The ordinance was crafted to regulate and encourage vintner operations through a tiered permit system that is tied to the amount of wine that they produce and the size of the operation. It's made it easier and less expensive for smaller wineries to open on-site retail outlets and tasting rooms. The 3-judge appellate court panel rejected a lawsuit filed by the San Diego Citizenry Group, which was largely centered on an argument that the county failed to properly assess the environmental impact of the ordinance. Supervisor Jacob is now leading efforts to craft a similar ordinance to encourage microbreweries, cheese-making operations, and other agriculture-based ecotourism ventures in rural areas of East County. The Board of Supervisors has agreed to explore the issue in the future. This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. A reward is being offered for information leading to the arrest and conviction of 4 suspects who left a dead rabbit in a box with a death threat at the home of a lakeside man. Dennis Richardson's photographs and stories have previously appeared in East County Magazine. He says he was shocked to find a gift-wrapped box in balloon gift wrap outside his home that surveillance cameras indicate was left about 1:20 in the morning on Tuesday, July 30th. It had a hand-scrawled threat reading, "Someone's gonna get beat with my bat." He called the sheriff, who dispatched a bomb arson squad, and they blew up the box, believing it to be a suspicious device. Inside, afterwards, they found a dead rabbit, brownish-gray rabbit, with a red ribbon tied around its neck. Surveillance video showed 4 male suspects in light-colored clothing. They left behind clues, including a shoebox for men's athletic shoes size 13, white active performance Succeed, manufactured by Champion and sold locally at Target. A video of the suspects has been posted on the Lakeside Eucalyptus Hills Facebook page that Richardson operates. He said he takes the threat seriously and noted that this is a federal offense to make terroristic threats. He has offered a $200 reward. He told East County Magazine that he's been visited by sheriff's investigators, spoken to federal authorities, and that Animal Control has also launched an animal cruelty investigation. He believes the threat may have been prompted by details that he posted on his community's Facebook page, where he has shared information about reckless drivers and what he calls kids running wild in the neighborhood. Anything that goes on in our community, we all know about it like a big family, he said. That's important because we are able to deter crime, and if there is something going on, we are able, within minutes, to share it with a couple of hundred people on Facebook, and that is powerful. If you have information on this incident, please call the Santee Sheriff's Office, which is investigating, and their phone number is 956-4037. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun. The other day I talked about a couple of plants that I've learned to hate over the years, and I've got a couple more I'd like to add to that list. Basically, I just kind of want to warn you off from planting them. One of them is a euphorbia. It's called Mexican cigarette tree. This is in the same family and very closely related to the sticks of fire. It's a very popular succulent because of its orange color. People love sticks of fire. The lucky thing about sticks of fire is it doesn't get enormous. The bad thing about Mexican cigarette tree is it's the green version of the same plant and it gets huge. It can easily get to be 8, 10, 12 feet tall. As it gets taller, even if you're not watering it, it fills with that milky euphorbia sap. That sap is incredibly dangerous. My husband and I were removing some of those off the property that we bought a few years ago, and one of the branches broke and splashed some of that sap next to my eye. By the time I went straight up into the house to rinse it off, I had already raised a blister. I mentioned this in class the following week, and one of my students told me that he had been removing those same Mexican cigarette trees from his property, and he got it in his eye and had to go to the emergency room. They were not so sure at all that they could save his vision. So this is just not something that you want to have on your property, hopefully. And if you do have it away from where you might be walking. Children might be playing. You might be so close to it riding a horse or something that you would break off a branch and get that sap on you. Incidentally, the sap of euphorbias, it doesn't show on your clothes when it first gets on. It looks kind of like Elmer's glue. You won't find out that you got it on your clothes until you send them through the washer and dryer. That white sweatshirt that you got the white sap on is going to come out with huge blood stains down the front of it where that euphorbia stuff has dried. So watch out for that plant. Another plant that I wish they wouldn't sell anymore is called Vinca major. It is a periwinkle. It's not an annual periwinkle. It's a perennial periwinkle. And when I say perennial, I mean it will be here after the nuclear holocaust when nothing is left on Earth except cockroaches and rats and Vinca. So it's the pretty one that is vining, and it has a blue flower and dark green leaves, and it's just wonderful as long as you like it and as long as you're willing to give it lots and lots and lots of water in the summertime, then you can keep it going and it'll look decent. But will come the day, doubtless someday, when you decide you want to re-landscape, you don't want that plant anymore. Good luck. Probably the only way to get rid of it would be to pave over it with 6 inches of concrete. So, Vinca major, stay away from that. It's not a friendly character. One more that I'll just mention in passing that is a really cute plant that I've seen people make a lot of mistakes with, including one poor lady who planted it all over a slope as a ground cover and has lived to regret it, is the Mexican evening primrose. It has pink flowers. It's a little vining character that gets about 6 inches tall, and then the flowers stick up another 6 inches. It's very, very cute. It's also very invasive. When you change your mind and realize that it doesn't play nicely with the other plants that are in your flower beds, it's already too late. You have got it forever. I did find one perfect way to use this plant, and that is I have it in my orchard. I put it next to the drip irrigation around my fruit trees, and because it learns to love that drip irrigation, it will bloom right under the fruit trees and be delightful looking, and then it won't go all over the whole yard because it doesn't want to go where there's no water. So maybe next time I can tell you about some plants that are good plants for your yard.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
This is Iris Neal. Join us for Job Talks, bringing you news about great jobs and growing our regional economy.
Job Talks on KNSJ's East County Magazine show is supported by our listeners and by the nonprofit San Diego Building Trades Family Housing Corporation, building our future.
This is Miriam Raftery, guest hosting for Iris Neal on today's Jobs Talk. If you are looking for a job or thinking of changing careers, you're going to want to turn your dial up and tune in and listen up, because we have two experts with us today who are going to give you some advice about how times have changed and what you need to know if you're looking for a job in today's market. My first guest is Antonio Viana. He has a long background in human resources. He's an author, career coach, and educator. Welcome, Antonio.
Thank you.
Our other guest today is Raina Menashe. Raina is a social worker, author, and teacher who teaches a life skills class for people who are coming out of rehab or are offenders who've actually spent time in prison. And she helps counsel them, among other things, on what to say when you're looking for a job. So welcome, Raina.
Thank you.
The first thing I'd like to talk about is resumes. Now, if you're sending a resume out and you're not getting a response, there could be some good reasons for that. Antonio, what advice would you give?
So many companies are asking for applicants to send resumes electronically, either directly to somebody in the company or post it on a platform like either a Monster or the company's website. And when you post your resume electronically, most people don't appreciate that the resume is actually scanned through a scanner, which is a machine that actually looks at your resume and tries to identify key code words that it wants in your resume that aligns with the company's values and the job descriptions. So if you're posting your resume electronically, you have to make sure that your resume includes those key code words.
Fascinating. And how do you know what those are?
Well, the job description probably includes some words that really will stand out to you about the job, as well as really the company's culture. So without misrepresenting yourself, you need to include those code words throughout your resume so that the scanner, not a person, the scanner picks up on that. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, your resume goes into a deep hole and you'll probably never hear from the company because, of course, a scanner won't respond to you.
Very good advice. Raina, how about you? What tips would you offer on creating the ideal resume?
My thoughts are more along the line of how can you make yourself look as good as possible. So if you have holes in your history, and just about everybody does, but some are more extreme than others, or areas that you're embarrassed about, or maybe you're concerned about ageism or something else, or there's a skill you want to de-emphasize, my point is to move the information around to highlight what you want highlighted and to de-emphasize what you want de-emphasized. So it's more along the lines of if somebody has not worked for a while or they have holes, how can they rearrange the information to tell the truth and yet highlight what they want
to highlight? So can you give an example or two of how you do that? I guess you don't have to have the resume in chronological order anymore.
So for example, you don't have to put the date that you graduated if you really don't want to point out that it was a long time ago. You don't have to put the same objective at the top of the resume. You can have different versions of your resume for different kinds of jobs that you're applying for. You can re-spin, while telling the truth, some time that you spent away from the work world. If you were traveling, whatever you were doing, you don't have to say it baldly the way that you might explain it to your best friend. And yet still, you must tell the truth.
I totally agree with that because the chronological resume where you give the years that you worked for certain companies may not be appropriate for many people. Therefore, you go to what is called a functional resume. You identify, as Raina has been saying, the key skills that you have, and you actually describe those skills and the accomplishments you've been able to arrive at using those skills. Therefore, you don't have to describe gaps. Mm-hmm. And I agree, we've all had gaps in our background that perhaps we don't want to share with someone else,
right,
or is very difficult to explain. So use a functional resume in that kind of situation.
And that can mean emphasizing the things that you are good at, your strong mm-hmm. points, the assets mm-hmm. and the values, and the things that you can bring to the company, the ways that you can help them.
Exactly. This resume, as we're saying, is really your calling card. It's saying who you are and what you can contribute to the organization for the company to solve its problems. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you're telling your story. I mean, Rita and I are both authors, so we know a lot about storytelling. But storytelling also means that you can tell the truth by editing out information of your life that is not relevant or appropriate for this particular job. And that's totally ethical, totally appropriate, totally legal.
And some of my clients say, you know, isn't that lying? And you're saying not to lie. But in the social work field or in the counseling field, we talk about reframing.
You gave an interesting example of that, the fellow that had been doing the cooking while he was in prison.
Right. There was a client who had done a lot of cooking while he was in prison, and he really loved cooking, and he wanted to go back to school, and he wanted to firm up that experience with a degree. And so we rearranged his resume so it really highlighted the number of people he had cooked for.
And in the state institution.
Yes. And it gave him the confidence, I think, to present himself better. And I want to mention another pet peeve about resumes, though, which is that if there are lots of errors on the resume, it really bothers me. I don't know if that's the writer in me, but
I would agree with that. You want to have somebody edit it. If English isn't your
right.
strong point, have somebody edit it who has those skills.
Right.
Yes. You're right. You want proper words. You want proper sentence structure. You want punctuation. And you want the resume to speak to the person who will be looking at the resume. For example, if you're an IT specialist and you have so many IT technical words or phrases that only IT people can understand, then your resume is not going to be very, very good. Or if you're coming out of the military and you talk about your military background using military lingo for a civilian job, that civilian company may not understand what you're saying. Mm-hmm. So know who your readership is and write your resume to that reader.
That's so true. I had an example of that myself. I helped a friend with a resume. He had done mainframe computers for large corporations. No job after 2 years of looking. And I looked at it and said, well, the problem is the resume is in geek speak. It was all the different programs he knew. I said, an HR person is going to want to know what that means and what you can do for their company. Have you ever saved the company you worked for money with everything you did? And it turned out he'd saved them a lot of money. So we rewrote it. Within a week, he had two interviews, and one of them turned into a very good job for him.
Well, that's great, and a great example of sort of knowing who your readership is and responding to the readership.
Now, something new that today's job hunters have to deal with that maybe my generation didn't need to is social networking, which can be a plus, but it can also be a drawback if the employer is reading about your wild and crazy past, or worse, your wild and crazy present on there. What advice would you give, Antonio, to job hunters about how to handle your social networking?
Well, social networking is really what it claims to be. It's meant to exchange social information with people of similar likes. What companies use social networking for is to find out opportunities to disqualify you from jobs mm-hmm. and disqualify you from their company. So you've got to be very careful about what you put on your social network page, even though you may think it's only going to your friends, your 5 million friends that you have around the world. It's going to more than your 5 million friends because that information is public knowledge. You have to be very careful about what you say, who you talk about, and about your background, because it will and can be used against you for a job search. My caution is be very careful. Twitter, Facebook are the social networks, but LinkedIn, which is more business-driven, you certainly want to be much more business talk and discussion and not have anything about your personal life with your LinkedIn account.
And I suggest that you just Google yourself. Go on the computer and see what comes up. And you'll see that your history is there. And to realize that your fingerprint is on everything that you do. Keep that in mind when you're out there having fun, because it's not just for your friends, as Tony was saying.
Mm-hmm. And you maybe, if you have things up there that an employer might find objectionable, you may want to go on and take some of those party photos off of Facebook.
That's right. And also think about, going back to what you're saying before about the resume, we didn't discuss holes in the resume. Mm-hmm. I think that just like you might take photos down off Facebook, mm-hmm. you might think about, what parts of my history do I not need to mention because it's not relevant? Again, it's not lying, because not everyone needs to know every piece of the story. You don't get all of the backstory. So if you don't want it out there, then it can't be out there.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have both.
And I also agree that even during the interview, when you're face-to-face with someone, if someone asks you a question that is not relevant to your ability to perform the job, a legitimate answer is to ask the question back, why are you asking me this? I don't see how it relates to my job performance. And you've got to sort of stand up and be bold about some things.
Would that be considered at all rude?
If a person is asking me something about my background that doesn't relate to the job, and they're nosy to that extent during the face-to-face, that may not be the kind of company that I want to work for.
Mm-hmm. So you're interviewing them as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's got to be a two-way process. But speaking now from an HR perspective, we do not like to have someone else control the interview. We want to control the interview.
Right.
So you're right. You have to be very careful about appearing to be very standoffish or tough or rough. But I think each of us have got to decide what we're going to share and what we're not going to share.
I think the bottom line is enthusiasm, genuine, authentic enthusiasm. If you have holes in your history, or you don't have much experience in this new field, or you're going back to school, or you're insecure for one reason or another, maybe you've been home raising kids and you're going back into the work world. If you're excited about the work for real, then they'll pick that up. Now, if you're not, that's where it takes more crafting and thought and repackaging so you can find something about it to be enthusiastic. Because again, I think people know when it's not authentic. I don't know, do you agree with that?
I totally agree. Is when you're interviewing someone who seems to be bored with about the topic that you're talking about, which is the job, and they're bored about what the company is about, its products or services, you begin to ask yourself, this person doesn't have any passion. And without passion, there's going to be boredom. And with boredom, there's going to be bad job performance. So you have to step it up. Or you simply don't interview for jobs and companies that you don't want to be part of. It's simply wasting everyone's time.
Very good point. Back to the interview itself, how should you dress for the interview?
I think you have to dress for the culture of the company and for the job. For example, at one time, I was interviewing for a vice president of human resources position in a company whose culture was very casual, which means that people dressed in casual clothes, there were no business suits, there were no ties. But I didn't know that. So I came into the job interview dressed in a dark suit with a white shirt and a dark tie with shiny shoes. And people looked at me as if I didn't belong. And even though the interview occurred, it was a short interview, and I knew exactly at the moment in time when I was rejected. And that is, I didn't look the part.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, again, know the audience that you're interviewing with and dress for the audience's success. Don't dress the way you want to dress.
This is relevant with tattoos and piercings. Something may be part of your personal style, but it may not be something you want to show up front. So I think if you have a lot of tattoos on your arms and things like that, you might want to wear long sleeves in the beginning until you see what the climate is, what the culture is.
Right. Unless you're applying to a tattoo parlor, that's probably wise advice.
Right.
What about the best places to find jobs nowadays? There's all kinds of electronic options out there we didn't used to have. Has the age-old advice of contacts count changed?
Contacts and networking count more than ever before. In the HR world, we call it shoulder tapping, which means that you know somebody who knows somebody who knows where there's a job opportunity. And that's really the best way today, unfortunately, where jobs get filled, is that you get to know somebody who knows where a job opportunity may exist or can introduce you to somebody who may be interviewing for certain kinds of jobs. So the idea of networking, become part of professional groups. So if you're an accounting person, join the accounting professional groups. If you're a human resources professional, join human resources professional groups to get to know the people who are in the profession that you want to be in, because your name will get referred to. I'm not saying don't submit resumes coldly, and I'm not saying do not respond to job ads, but the shoulder tapping and the personal contacts is paramount today.
And I suggest to students to hoard business cards. So anytime you go somewhere, you hear a speaker, those business associations you're talking about, get a business card from everybody and put them in one book. And then when you're trying to make contact and looking out there for a job, you know, email everybody and say, I saw you speak at this and that. It's more personal.
Yes, and passing out your own business cards is important too.
I
can say the best job I ever had was an editor I had met at a party, had handed her the card, never got any writing work from her, but she passed my card along the next day to someone who called asking for writers, and I wound up with a full-time editing job out of that.
That's an excellent excellent example, because even though you're considering working for a corporation, you know, a large company or even a small and medium-sized company, where you'll get a business card from the company, having your personal business card with your name, your contact, and your functional area of expertise is really sort of paramount. Mm-hmm. And you know, Rena, I've always kind of wondered why students never ask us as faculty members for our business cards. They should be doing that on a regular basis, because we are experts in a certain area that they may be able to leverage down the road.
Mm-hmm. At the Honor Society, I do encourage them to get business mm-hmm. cards from every speaker who comes in, but you're right, they don't usually ask us.
Well, thank you both for joining us here today, and we really appreciate you taking the time to come in and share your expertise with our listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery with KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. I'm here today with John Mattis, an award-winning investigative reporter. He's got a site called The Investigative Guy, and he's also with MuchBetterChoices.com. John, tell us a little bit about some of the awards that you've won for your reporting through the years.
Over the years, I've exposed mortgage fraud, I've exposed used car scams, I've exposed the issue of water for people in Lakeside, and where that water was going and where it was coming from. Those are some of the issues. They've been consumer issues across a broad range of areas that I've won awards for as a reporter. And now I'm, as a consumer advocate, trying to take mm-hmm. on the issue.
You've won an Emmys, I understand.
A number of Emmys, a Murrow, and a Golden Mike Award for some of the exposés I've done
Very
regarding
good.
Corruption here in San Diego County.
And now you're taking on SDG&E. Tell us about the petition that you have started to try to get some money back for the ratepayers.
It's rather simple. What happened is, we all know the history of what happened at San Onofre. The utilities conspired with Mitsubishi to put in repairs and not tell the NRC fully what was going
on. Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
And Senator Boxer exposed that in a letter and found that there was an attempt to cover up what really had been going on there. Well, sadly, after 2 years, there was leaks, and they had to shut the plant down. Now, let's fast forward to the present. The operators of the plant, the utility, is now telling the public and regulators that, in fact, they want us, the consumers, to pay for their mistakes. Now, their mistakes aren't minor. It's not $20 here or there. It's a minimum $600 million mistake.
More than $500 million that SDG&E wants the ratepayers instead of its shareholders to pay for. Now, you have an idea that there's a much better choice out there. Tell us what that is and what you're trying to do about it.
We have a website called MuchBetterChoices.com, and we've started a simple petition. It says, we don't want to pay for your mistakes at San Onofre. And this is directed at SDG&E, and we're asking all of our elected officials to take a stand and intervene to protect us, the ratepayers. We know that there are going to be massive rate increases due to their mistakes at SDG&E, and the petition specifically directs our elected representatives to intervene with the Public Utilities Commission and stand on our behalf. When's the last time you heard a public official mention the words consumer protection? Isn't it about time they start protecting us? This isn't an issue for Democrats, Republicans. This is an issue for taxpayers. This is an issue for all of us.
I understand that you're getting quite a few signatures already, and that it's from people in all different political parties.
It's an issue that cuts across all parties. Think about accountability. We're asked to be accountable in our personal behavior. We expect the same from the corporation. We're taught as small children that we should clean up our own messes. That's all I'm asking them to do. Clean up your mess. Don't bill me for your mistakes at SDG&E. And what we're hoping that people will do is sign this petition, share it with their neighbors, go online to MuchBetterChoices.com, sign it, hand it to your neighbors, so that we can tell the politicians here in San Diego County that we expect them to protect us, not the utility.
Now, I understand that you are sending this, the petition is going automatically to the chairman of the Board of Supervisors, the mayor of San Diego, the city attorney, and that afterwards you plan to also hand deliver copies to some of our East County political officials. Is that correct?
We're going to take it to every elected body here in San Diego County and even further north, because the issue cuts across all geographic boundaries. It's an issue of, shouldn't cities protect themselves? They buy electricity. Shouldn't cities protect us? And it isn't just San Diego. It isn't just Chula Vista. It's every single city. And all the people here in San Diego County, we've gotten those letters from SDG&E. They want more money from us, and they haven't even yet billed us, they claim, for
right,
the
they're talking about a 9 to 11% increase, and I believe that does not even include this $500 million or more for the repairs at San Onofre. So we're talking another increase on top of that?
It's going to go on. And the critical point is that we can intervene. There is a process at the Public Utilities Commission. They're going to decide whether we consumers are going to pay for the mistakes or the shareholders. Why should ratepayers pay for the mistakes of corporate executives?
Now, shareholders, the company can certainly afford this. SDG&E, I understand, had record profits last year. Is that correct?
Of course. They can afford it. This is something that is based on corporate risk. They took the risk. They screwed up. Now, they're asking us to pay. I say no thank you.
And that seems to be a pattern with SDG&E, certainly with the wildfires, where the PUC found that they were responsible for causing some of the 2007 wildfires, and yet SDG&E was trying to get the PUC to let it make ratepayers pay for that as well. The PUC so far said no to that offer, and now you're wanting them to say no to this one as well.
Think about a small business. If a small business makes a mistake, they can't go to their customer and say, oh, by the way, can you pay for the mistakes I made last year? Of course not. Why does this company think that they can get away with it? Is it just because they're so big? Is it just because they're so powerful? Is it just because they think they control the Public Utilities Commission? I say no.
Thank you very much, John, for joining us here today. And again, you can find that petition online at www.muchbetterchoices.com. And we will also be posting a copy of it at eastcountymagazine.org very soon as well.
Thank you.
Howdy! East County Magazine and KNSJ invite you to our Barbecue and Wild West Fest on Saturday, August 10th from 4 to 7 p.m. at the historic Descanso Town Hall in Descanso. Round up your friends and family for this fun-filled event. We'll have a Wild West show featuring the Hole-in-the-Wall Gang and the Gaskell Brothers reenacting scenes from our region's colorful Western past. The Pine Creek Posse Band will provide live music, so grab your partner and bring your dancing shoes, or should we say cowboy boots. Plus, the Descanso Junction will be cooking up a tri-tip barbecue feast. We'll also have prizes and surprises at our Wild West Fest, which is all a benefit to support our wildfire reporting, alerts, and nonprofit community news. Yee-haw! Reservations are going fast, so save your spot now for our August 10th Wild West Fest. Call 619-698-7617 or email editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Today, you can also find more details at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
On August 9th, Rising from the Ashes, a fundraiser will be held to help raise money for cleanup costs of the Shrine Camp on Mount Laguna, which was devastated by the Chariot Fire. The Shrine Camp lost 23 buildings in the blaze, including the Shriner's 99-year-old lodge. The Albar Shrine Center in San Diego will host the event from 5 to 11 p.m. in the Red Fez Room at the Albar Shrine Center. The event will include dinner and entertainment. The Shriners, an international organization, provide philanthropic services, including operating 22 hospitals for children. For more information, visit www.albarshrine.org. For KNSJ on Mount Laguna, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
This is Jake Christie, and we're here today with Nadine Abbott, our East County Magazine field reporter who's been covering wildfires in our region. Wildfire season is approaching. Nadine, what advice does CAL FIRE have for backcountry residents?
CAL FIRE advises residents in the backcountry to have a defensible space of 100 feet around their property. They will also come and help check to see if it's okay and you have enough space that they can defend in case of a fire. This defensible space is vital for them to be able to protect your property in case of a major fire.
What's the latest news on the Ramona Air Traffic Control Tower, which the FAA has said it plans to close due to sequestration cuts?
The FAA has said that they are going to delay the closure of the Ramona Air Traffic Control Center until June 15. And Supervisor Diane Jacob has pointed out, if the federal government is really concerned about safety and fire safety in particular, they should take that into consideration and help defend this air traffic control and keep it open.
What are the most common causes of the wildfires in our region?
There are several causes of wildfires in our region. Some of them are nature-borne, such as the lightning strikes we had last year, which we had about 1,000 of them, and we had a fire at the Chihuahua Valley, for example, that was caused by lightning. But also, when people use weed whackers, those can cause sparks, and it's important that when you weed whack your property, to have water or a fire extinguisher nearby, and to help to protect from that. The other important source of fires in our region is when people go target shoot in the backcountry when it's really, really dry. CAL FIRE has said that in California state parks, you cannot do that. But the Bureau of Land Management still allows it. So use some common sense. And if it's dry out there, go to the target range and do your target shooting at a range. Because if you cause a fire, you can be held liable.
Well, thank you very much, Nadine, and keep up the reporting.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community. This is Sierra Robinson. The San Diego City Council has unanimously approved a master plan for the San Diego River Park. The plan, backed by the San Diego River Park Foundation, will ultimately create a series of parks and trails stretching from Julian in the mountains of East County to the Pacific Ocean.
You're listening to East County Magazine, the voice of East County. We reflect your interests, the people's interests, not special interests. As a nonprofit, we rely on community support. You can help us provide community news and reflect a rich diversity of voices by donating or becoming a sustaining member at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
Pertussis, more commonly known as whooping cough, is a very serious disease, especially for infants. It's often spread to babies from older kids or adults who may not even know they have it. Whooping cough is a real threat to your baby today. To stay protected, get your baby and everyone around your baby vaccinated. Vaccination is protection. Learn more at www.cdc.gov/pertussis. A message from CDC.
This is a public service announcement from the County of San Diego. The County Assessor Recorder wishes to advise all property owners whose property was damaged or destroyed in the Chariot fire that property tax relief is available. This tax relief program requires the reassessment of the property to reflect the damaged condition. The reduced value will remain in effect until the property is rebuilt or repaired. After the property is rebuilt or repaired, owners can retain their previous taxable value if the property is rebuilt in a like manner. This means that the property tax assessment will not increase beyond what it was before the fire. This tax relief is available for any property damage, including homes, outbuildings, commercial and industrial properties, and mobile homes. Damage to vehicles and contents of a home, such as furniture, are not eligible for this tax relief.
County Clerk Ernest Dronenberg says he is sympathetic with fire victims and strongly encourages all property owners who suffered fire damage to their property in excess of $10,000 to contact his office for the necessary claim form. You can get that by calling 619-531-4993 or visiting the Assessor Clerk's website at www.sdarcc.com. That's sdarcc.com. The assessor's office has already mailed information and claim forms to some affected property owners and will continue to do so as more information becomes available. For KNSJ and East County Magazine, this is Miriam Raftery. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's live radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.